Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Keith Krueger, and today we're very fortunate to be joined by The Economist's Thomas Piketty, professor at the Paris School of Economics and a director of the School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences. As many of our listeners will know, Professor Piketty's research focuses on wealth and income inequality, and he remains most famous for his 2014 bestseller, Capital in the 21st Century, the English translation published by Belknap Press, an imprint of Harvard University Press. That book, built on historical data going back to the Industrial Revolution and focused primarily on Western countries, their concentrations of wealth, and how inequality dovetails with our economic model. Paul Krugman, the New York Times economist, described the book as the most important book of the year and maybe of the decade. The professor's latest book, out last month with the same publisher, Capital and Ideology, expands the regional coverage of its comparative historical analysis and the interdisciplinary breadth of its argument that inequality is neither economic nor technological. It is ideological and political. Professor Piketty, Thomas, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Hey, before we dive into your latest thesis, many of us would be interested in hearing about your academic influences and just a bit of background that led to Capital in the 21st Century and now Capital and Ideology.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, so there's been 6 years between the two books and a lot of traveling, a lot of thinking, a lot of new research. And well, let me say, I think Capital and Ideology is a much more interesting book than Capital in the 21st Century. I think, I'm making progress over time, and hopefully I will keep making progress. I guess there are several limitations of Capital in the 21st Century, which I came to realize more clearly after all the discussion. I was very fortunate to have, after the release of this first book, Probably the two important limitations are first that, you know, Capital in the 21st Century was too much Western centered, and next that it did not focus enough on the political and ideological aspect of inequality and the transformation of inequality regime. So in a way, you know, I have moved more and more into the political science aspect, the political ideology aspect of inequality, a little bit away from sort of pure economics. And I think the account I provide in this new book of the evolution of inequality is both richer and more accurate. And as you were summarizing, you know, one of the main conclusions is that if you want to account for this very large diversity of trajectories that we observe across time over societies, especially, you know, taking a very global perspective and not only looking at the Western world, you see the driving force of inequality as being primarily political, ideological. You have very fast transformation of inequality regime across time over countries, you know, which are very difficult to explain just on the basis of economic or technological forces. Crises like, including, you know, social crises, financial crises, revolution like the French Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution or other revolutionary events, financial crises, maybe sanitary crises like the one we have today, have a big impact on the transformation of dominant views about the economy, about how to regulate the economy, and ultimately about the structure of inequality in society. And this long historical process will continue in the future. And I think, you know, one of the best way to prepare ourselves for this is to look at this rich history, which is what I invite the readers to do in my new book.
Hey, you wrote about historical ruptures that lead to switch points. Do you feel like the world is experiencing one now? Our current historical moment, is this pandemic a kind of switch point, do you think?
It could, but to be honest, we don't know at this stage, and I think it's a bit too early to talk about the, you know, the long-term impact. You know, the priority at this stage is just to try to avoid a complete apocalyptic evolution in terms of number of deaths. And you know, at this stage, we really don't know, you know, where this is going to last, how, you know, where this is going to end. You know, I'm particularly concerned, you know, in the south part of the world and the poorest country of the world, you know, having this big lockdown is not going to work for very long because, you know, people don't have a safety net in India or in Africa, and they can't stay home for very long. They will have to go out very fast and get work and get money and get food and so you know, in principle, this could be an opportunity to accelerate the development, for instance, of safety net and minimum income scheme in countries like India or in West Africa, so as to make the fight against the virus sustainable and not come at the cost of a huge loss of income and huge loss in living condition, which could have terrible consequences, especially coming together with the virus. So, okay, at this stage, you know, there are urgent issues on how to try to avoid the enormous increase in the casualties, and this is really the priority. Now, whether this will have a lasting impact on other dimensions of how we regulate the economy, I would like this to be true, but you know, I think it's a bit too early to say. One general lesson that I stress in my book is that crises, you know, sometimes are necessary to get the change in ideology that is needed, but they are never sufficient. You know, in the sense that crises can also lead to sometimes business as usual after the crisis, can also not lead to sometimes, you know, it can also lead to the reinforcement of nationalism or, you know, identity politics. We really don't know at this stage, and I think it's I think it's a good time. You know, we unfortunately, most of us, you know, we can't do much right now apart from staying at home and following the rules that have been set by the health authorities. And you know, I think it's a good time certainly to think about the future. I think it's a good time to read. I'm sorry that my book is a little long, but I think, you know, it's very readable. And, I think it's a good time, you know, certainly to reflect and think about the past and about the future.
Sure. And as a way into your book, and it is a long book for sure. Hey, what do you mean when you say every human society must justify its inequalities?
Well, because, you know, humans need to give meaning and to give sense to their existence and to their social existence and to the societies in which they live. So in every human societies, you know, you have inequalities, of course, you never have perfect equality and will never have perfect equality. But what's interesting is that people need to tell stories, to tell narratives about why, you know, these inequalities are justified. So you will never find a society where, you know, the rich will simply say, you know, okay, we are rich, you're poor, and, you know, that's life, and you're here to work for us. You know, it's always more sophisticated. So the rich or the dominant groups in general in societies will always say something like, okay, we are rich, but, you know, we are providing you with various services, which in the end make inequality in the common interest. So it could be that we provide, in ancient societies, we provide, if you are the warrior class or the nobility, you provide law and order to the rest of society, which is, of course, something very important, especially in very chaotic times. Or if you are the old religious class or the clergy, you provide spiritual guidance, educational services. And, in societies where educational services or health services are very poor, religious organization and the religious class did provide to some extent some of these services. Now, in modern societies, especially after the French Revolution and after the Atlantic Revolution of the late 18th century, in the 19th century, you have less and less of this nobility or clergy missions justifying their dominance over societies, but you have a different kind of justification based on the idea that the richest group in societies provide they still provide stability. The idea that you need to have people at the top who have more property accumulation, because if you start questioning this, where are you going to stop? And that's going to put complete chaos in society. And also the elite starting in the 19th century is supposed to provide innovation, to provide economic growth. And this is something certainly that's still very important today in a discourse of justification of inequality. And let me say right away that this belief system and justification are always partly right. At least they need to have some minimal level of plausibility. So of course the elites in every society will tend to exaggerate a little bit how much they bring to the rest of society. And sometimes it's not only a little bit, it can be a lot, but it must have some, their claims must have at least some plausibility for societies to accept them and to sustain. If it's completely implausible, then you have a revolution, you have something happening, and the system will move to a different inequality regime and to a different set of organization of inequality. And so this is this story of sort of learning about justice in the end, learning about different ways to structure inequality, which I'm trying to tell in this book. And so it's a little bit of an idealistic view of history in the sense that I stress, the sincere part of this belief system and the fact that they always have some plausibility. But, I'm trying to be not too naive. I know at the same time that many of these claims are self-serving.
Well, you also mentioned the contradictions in these narratives, which I found interesting, and that they take different forms in different parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So the contradictions, yes, there are lots of contradictions which I study in the book, which in the end lead to turning point and lead to a change in regime. Starting with, today's main contradiction about the globalization narrative and market competition narrative is that, this economic regime of competition between countries and, sophisticated mobility of capital and goods and services across the world is supposed to benefit the entire population, is supposed to lead to prosperity to all classes. And in practice, in fact, you have a lot of inequality. You have very high and rising inequality in recent decades. And so many people in the middle class or in the lower socioeconomic group, feel that this globalization is not working for them. And so that this is sort of the basic contradictions that we have today. If you look at the past, you see similar contradiction leading to change in regime, together with other forms of contradiction, in particular in relation to the international dimension of the inequality regime. So, for instance, the inequality regime that we have until World War I is very much based on the colonial system and the fact that enormous competition between European state powers in order to colonize the world, in order to accumulate foreign assets in the rest of the world. And this is going to trigger a competition between these state powers, in particular Germany, France, and Britain, which is going to lead to World War I, World War II, and to a complete destruction of the sort of proprietarian international order of 1914. So this is probably the most extreme example of an internal contradiction you can think of, because in effect it led the world to close to complete destruction. So today's contradiction, are less dramatic in a way, but I think we should take them seriously, because just like during the first half of the 20th century, these contradictions, if they are not addressed through new, peaceful, democratic institutions and narratives and ideology, the vacuum will be filled by ideologies stressing identities, just like during the first half of the 20th century. If you don't know how to regulate economic forces, then you will emphasize, local, national identities. You will emphasize, borders, returning to very sacralized view of borders in order to solve problems, which in practice, is not going to solve the problem we have to solve. This was not the way to solve the problem a century ago, and this is not the way to solve the problem today, especially with the new challenges we have to address in terms of global warming, rising inequality, or, the kind of new challenges that we are just currently facing, which is requiring, obviously, a lot of international cooperation. The problem is that we have this ideology of the market competition as solving every problem, the ideology of property sacralization, the idea that accumulation of property and capital in a few hands can always solve the problem we have to solve. This ideology, which was very powerful in the 19th century and until World War I, has become very powerful again starting in the 1980s, 1990s, in part due to the fall of Soviet communism, which was another kind of ideology which led to a dramatic failure, of course, and which in a way reinforced a sort of hyper-capitalist ideology, and we still live in this legacy. I mean, of course, the 2008 crisis and possibly this 2020 epidemic have started to change the dominant belief system somewhat, but I think it's still not enough in the sense that we still live in an era of sort of post-communist era of sort of very large disillusion about the possibility of a different economic system than just free market capitalism. So I actually think that another economic system is possible, but I think this will require a lot of intellectual political work, to which I'm trying to contribute in order to have a sort of new hope and new political mobilization in this direction.
You wrote about the Great Replacement. Can you elaborate just for a second on that, and then we'll move on?
Ethnic identity, for a long time as part of the system of political cleavage, in the United States for obvious reason, after the end of slavery, there was for a long time a system of very hard racial segregation. Now, starting in the 1960s, there was a civil rights movement, trying to bring more equality between ethnic groups. But, it's clear that the political expression of ethnic identity and cleavage, is still playing, has always played an important role in a country in the U.S. And many observers feel that this has contributed to the lack of development of a welfare state in the U.S. comparable to what we have in Europe. Now, in Europe, there used to be much more limited ethnic division within European countries. So there was huge external division in the colonial system between the colonizer and the colonized countries. But within the European countries, these ethnic divisions were limited until the 1970s, 1980s. They have become bigger today. I mean, it's still ideology of the Great Replacement is, of course, a complete, exaggeration of the magnitude. It's based on a complete exaggeration magnitude of the strength. Today, you have about 10% of the population in Europe that has family origins outside Europe. you know, in particular in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa in the case of France, or sometimes coming from Turkey in the case of Germany, or coming from South India, or South Asia and India in the case of Britain. But if you take all this extra European origin together, you know, there are typically 10% of the population in France, Germany, Britain. You know, it's still a very small minority. Comparable in a way to the African American minority in the US. But this has been, unfortunately, enough to generate all this new extreme right political movement, in particular in France, in my country, but now this is much more general in Europe. And I think this is partly the consequence of the kind of ideological vacuum on economic issues which I was referring to earlier. So, you know, if you keep telling people that there is no other economic system, that, you know, there's only one economic policy that governments do is to control their borders and to control their identity, then, you know, we should not be surprised that politics is becoming more and more a discussion about border control and the control of identity. So I think the lack of an economic discussion about how to organize the economy, how to reduce inequality in income, in property, in education between social groups, which will be a way to, you know, to show different people with different origins that they have, in fact, a lot in common in order to obtain, you know, better wages or better access to education or better access to property. But if you abandon indeed, you know, all these stories about replacement and identity politics get a lot more strength.
One of the things that you bring up is you make the case that there's not enough transparency with regard to wealth ownership in the world. And one of the authors, Jonathan Rothwell, he's an economist at Gallup. He was on the New Books Network recently, and he wrote a book called The Republic of Equals. And he argues, at least with regard to the U.S. case, that the rising inequality with regard to income, at least, can be traced to the rise of S corporations and partnerships, basically legal and accounting entities in which, you know, professional sectors really take advantage, doctors, lawyers, CEOs, basically groups that can shape regulation through their lobbying efforts. Does this factor in? I mean, is this part of the transparency issue that you talk about?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting argument. It's not exactly the same argument that I'm making, but I think potentially this is complementary. I'm very much stressing, you know, in my book, in my work, you know, the illusion of the big data society. You know, we live in this illusion that, you know, because of new technology, we have more data than ever before, more transparency than ever before. But in fact, what we realize is that maybe we are in big data in terms of how much private firms and private monopolies can accumulate information sometimes about our personal life and our personal data. But in terms of government ability to collect information and to observe what you need to observe, in fact, we are in an era of big opacity, in particular in terms of wealth ownership. And, you know, it's a political choice that, you know, we have created a system of capital mobility where you have almost a sacralized right, you know, to transfer your assets wherever you want without anybody being able to follow you. But, you know, this is not something natural at all. This is a very sophisticated international legal system, a very sophisticated set of international treaties that have made this possible. And in the end, this is what I think will have to be changed at some point, you know, if we want to reconcile, you know, the public opinion with globalization, because this is part of what leads to extreme tax competition and to the benefit of the highest wealth income groups. And this is what end, the middle groups and the lower groups who are less mobile end up, paying more and more tax in order to compensate for this tax competition to the benefit of the top. So I think in the end, this is threatening the system. It's interesting that this sort of opacity that we have about wealth is also something that we see today, with the epidemic crisis, where we suddenly realize that, governments who are supposed to be very sophisticated, in Europe, in the US, they have in fact no information about who is infected. They have not the technology and the resources in order to have tests of the population at a large scale. And in fact, the only thing we are able to do, is to force people to stay at home, which is really the less sophisticated thing you could do, because in principle, it would be good to collect information about who is infected, have a complete isolation for those who are infected, but those who are not infected could keep working or doing what they have to do. So the fact that you have technology in itself does not guarantee transparency. What matters is the organization and the collective institution and the rules, and in particular, the development of a collective and state capacity to observe inequality in income or wealth or inequality in health, and to design the policies in order to correct for this and to offer the appropriate regulation. But the big lesson of history is that, again, this is not technological or economic. This is primarily political, ideological, and institutional.
It seems like there's a bit of a pushback on your analysis from some groups that really resist anything to do with taxation.
The question is their position justified? So is the level of inequality, we are not talking about having complete equality. The question is how much inequality is useful. And in the case of the US, the huge increase in the concentration of wealth that we've seen in recent decades, I think it's very difficult to justify on the basis of increased innovation or increased economic growth, because in fact, we've not seen this increased economic growth. If the growth rate of the US economy had doubled since the time of Reagan, our entire discussion would be very different. But this is not the world that we have. In fact, the growth rate of per capita income in the US has been divided by two since the time of Reagan. So I think, it's important that we all have the numbers in mind. Between 1950 and 1990, it was the national income per capita was rising at 2.2% per year in the United States. Between 1990 and 2020, it's been 1.1. And so here we are comparing very long period of time, 30-year period, 40-year period. So you always have business cycle in all period. You have crises, you have booms. But when you compare such long period of time and you have a division by two of the growth rate, it means that the idea that by having more inequality, more billionaire, you will stimulate innovation. And because of this, very efficient working rich, this is going to benefit to the rest of society. That's an interesting theoretical claim, but in practice, it's very hard to substantiate this claim. So I think it's important to look at all these pieces of information and reconsider some of this conclusion.
Your book is divided into 17 chapters. You've got four parts. Just real quickly, is there a lay of the land in terms of the broad inequality regimes that you could share with our listeners?
Well, the book is basically chronological. So, I first look at the transformation from societies based on nobility or clergy, which were more based on complementarity between groups, sort of each group bringing something to society of very different nature, then moving to proprietarian society in the 19th century, the way they fell in the 20th century between 1914 and 1945, largely because of the contradiction I described before, and in particular the international colonial system, which in a way was the most extreme dimension, accumulation of property and foreign capital and foreign property, for that matter, until 1914. And then since the fall of Soviet communism in the 1990s, I think have led to the entry of a sort of new world, which is not exactly like the 19th century ideology, but as a sort of similar, sometimes almost religious faith in property accumulation as the solution to all problems. And I think we are starting to exit, this ideology, because we realize that, private property is a very useful institution as long as it remains of reasonable magnitude. And how do we decide what's the reasonable magnitude of inequality and how large should the concentration of wealth go? Well, the basic response of my book and my research is to say, well, we have to use history as a guide for the level of inequalities that are useful and not useful. And, the big increase in inequality we've seen in recent decades, especially in the US, I think, has not been very useful in terms of growth and improved living condition for the most of the population. And, therefore we have to adapt. And I think we are starting to adapt our view to this reality. Sometimes it takes time, sometimes it takes crisis. But, I think in the long run, the book takes a relatively optimistic outlook in the sense that, there's a long run process toward more equality. We've seen a huge reduction of inequality in the long run, especially over the course of the 20th century. And we're still today in much more equal societies than in the 19th century. And I think this has been a huge success. This is what has allowed, it has come together with more increase in education, in health, and also with increased prosperity. I think historically, the true source of economic prosperity is education and a certain level of equality in education. And in particular, the source of U.S. prosperity historically has been the fact that the U.S. as a country was an educational leader as compared to Europe in particular. And in the middle of the 20th century, in the 50s, you have almost the entire population in the U.S. going to high school at a time where in Europe or Japan, it's less than 20 or 30% of the generation going to high school. And it was this educational leadership that made the U.S. an economic leader. This has ceased to be the case, partly because of this new ideology starting in the 1980s, 90s, that basically saying that more inequality is always good, and that we don't care too much about equality or educational equality. And this will change again. I think that's the main message of the book, is that these things should not be taken for as given.
Hey, last question for you, Professor. It seems fair to say that for comparative and interdisciplinary social study, you pretty much set the bar with capital in the 21st century. Now you've extended the reach of your analysis by looking at the discourse of justification. And that is a society's ideology with even more historical data reaching beyond the Western world now with capital and ideology. What are you working on now?
It took me 6 years, to write Capital and Ideology after the release of Capital in the 21st Century. So please give me a break. I need a little more time to. But no, look, I'm certainly going to keep working on ideologies and the transformation of political attitude. So in the last part of Capital and Ideology, I show a lot of the research I've been doing in the past 2 or 3 years on political attitudes and the changing structure of electorate and the rise of what I describe as the Brahmin left and merchant right. And these are issues on which I keep working today with more better data on the electoral coalition and looking at more countries again and who votes for what and how this changes over time. So, I'm probably going to keep working in this direction.
Well, that sounds good. Hey, thanks so much for your time, Professor.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.